one thing I want to say before I get into this is don't get discouraged at what you already see out there. You might say, oh my gosh, there's already a billion cat toys, or there's 50 billion, you know, body care items. But the wonderful thing is that there is not anything that is a duplicate of what you have. What you have is something unique, and there is room for it if you want to take the opportunity to disrupt the market in that category to make way for the product that you're bringing. That was kind of one of the things that I dealt with in taking my product to the market. It's like, oh my gosh, there's already a million other hair care products. Why would anybody want to buy mine? And I'll get into that in just a moment. So before we talk about getting into mass retail, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about who I am so you'll be able to know who this weirdo is talking to you. So I went into mass retail behind my natural hair journey. So I chopped all my hair off. So behind me, shaving my head bald, is where I found a passion for hair and hair care products. So I don't know how many of you know about black hair care, but a lot of women that are African American chemically relax our hair because otherwise it looks like this. And when it looks like this, it takes hours and sometimes days to perform a task such as washing your hair, detangling your curls, moisturizing it, getting it ready to style, and then waiting for it to dry. It takes days for my hair to dry because it's so thick, because it's so curly, it gets so tangled. So most women say, you know what, to heck with that. I want to go the easier route. I'm going to get a relaxer in my hair. Well, at one point in time in my life, my hair was super duper damaged. I had dandruff, I had breakage, I had shedding. So I decided to shave all my hair off and start over, clean slate, start over. Let's start from scratch. And I said I was not going to get any relaxers. Well, once I went that route, I realized that there was no products for my hair on the shelf anywhere. I was buying the same stuff I used to wear for my hair, and nothing worked for my hair. So I had to create what didn't exist. I had to create something that worked for me. And in that process, I started in my kitchen. Like most of you probably, you know, have started in your homes making products, whether it's items you make with your hands, whether it's knitting or sewing or gluing things or getting in the kitchen, developing scientific experiments, hoping they turn out right. You start somewhere in your home, and that's exactly what I did. I remember the day I got started. It was a Friday evening. I was a single parent at the time. My boys were much younger. They were probably like 5 and 7, 5 and 8 or something like that. And I was so excited because I had went on Amazon and eBay and I bought all this stuff. Didn't know what I was going to do with this stuff, but I had beeswax and almond oil and shea butter and just everything. And I got these pots boiling all on the stove, probably breaking every rule in the FDA handbook on how to prepare products for hair and skin. And I didn't know how to make a cream, so I'm mixing water and oils and nothing's blending. And I come up with a solution of this sticky wax stuff, and I would call one of my boys in the kitchen, and I would grease it on them to see how it fit and how it works. And then I would realize, no, that's not good, and they would run off and play. They were running around literally with no shirts on, covered in this beeswax substance, because I was trying to figure out how to make a cream for, I figured if I can make something for skin, then I can in turn make it for hair. So that is how it all started. I still have one of my very first jars that I created stuff with. It was so thick. I had so much like beeswax and other stuff in it that you literally had to dig it out with your fingernail. You couldn't just scoop it out and apply it. And when you would rub it in between your hands, it wouldn't even melt. That's just how much wax it was. But humble beginnings, I have to look at that to remind myself where I came from and why I started. Because if you've been in business long enough, between upset customers and other mishaps, you can sometimes forget why you started to do the thing that you love to do. So I take pictures of stuff like that. So even when I'm feeling discouraged, I can go back and look and say, hey, you were making this stuff in a 6x9 square foot kitchen at one time. So, you know, you are making progress. So those kind of things help me. So introducing Naturally Smitten, this is a brand that I created for natural hair, and I created everything from the formulation down to the design of the product label, all the way down to the copywriting on the label. As you know, as creatives, sometimes you have to be technical support, web designer, product developer, marketer, shipping and logistics. You have to be internet personality, video editor. You have to be all those things. And that's kind of how I started. And it was a rough patch to have to do everything on my own, but I learned so much from it. And in addition to that, I was able to kind of create my story and to create my voice and to create products based on how I want them to look, based on what I like and what I like to see. So this is the product that I have today. Currently, it's still carried in a few Walmart stores, and we're on Amazon as well. In addition to being on Amazon, we're carried in a couple of retailers across the world. We've got retailers in France, the Caribbean, Australia, and the UK, and we're currently working on accounts in Barbados and Trinidad. So these are pictures from when I pitched to Sally and Walmart. So how I got into Walmart was I was on Facebook wasting time one day, and I scrolled across this ad that said Walmart was looking for American-made products by minorities. Not minorities as in skin color, that's one of them, but minorities as in women as well. So women, Walmart is looking to carry products that are made by you that are manufactured in the U.S. And it's called Open Call. I think they have it maybe once a year, maybe twice a year, not sure. But I pitched my products to Walmart Open Call, and I thought I was going to be completely laughed out of Walmart's system once they looked at my product and looked at what kind of sales I had, because obviously products that are on Walmart shelves, you think that they are selling millions and millions of dollars, and a lot of them are. So when I filled out the application and Walmart was asking me stuff like, well, what did you make last year? And I was like, you know, like $1,500. You know, I didn't, had to tell them the truth. But, you know, it for me, it was eye-opening because it made me force some insecurity. It made me to be forced to, like, view some insecurities that I had about myself as a business owner and my product, because what it was asking me to do was also to compare myself to products that were already carried on Walmart shelves. And that's something that I hadn't done. So I had to look at my competitors in that category, and I had to say, this is what my product is, but, you know, I'm hoping one day I'll be like one of those guys. So Walmart looked at my application, and they somehow approved it, and they had me come to Bentonville to pitch to their buyers. And I really knew then, like, maybe someone overlooked a decimal or a comma or something somewhere, and that they were going to find me out and escort me out the facility to the parking lot. Because when I went to Open Call, we were in a big Coliseum-type room, and there were thousands of suppliers in there, and a lot of them were from major brands that you and I probably utilize a lot. Tide, I don't know if you're familiar with Amy's or Procter & Gamble, like there were people in there that had those products that were looking to pitch more products to Walmart, because why? Everybody wants to be in Walmart. It's the number one retailer in the company. So somehow, by my luck, I was the first interviewee at Walmart. You know, out of all these thousands of people, how was I number one on the, you're going to be the first one we interview today? I'm like, okay, great. You know, my heart is beating out of my chest. I'm sweating bullets by this time. And I go in there and meet with the buyer. And I was fortunate enough prior to that to know a person who knew a person who used to work at Walmart as a buyer. So she was able to tell me in advance what buyers are looking for when you go to pitch to them. It's not that you just go and take your product. You have to have a complete marketing strategy. You have to know what your product is going to do in different markets. You suggest different markets to them. So I had all of that put together prior to me going to meet with the buyer, and just coincidentally, she asked me all the questions that were on the presentation that I had. And at the end of our maybe 30, 45 minute meeting, she said, I'd like to move forward. I was like, well, what does that mean? And she said, you know, we'd like to get your product on our shelf sometime next year. You know, retailers plan like maybe 12 to 18 months in advance, maybe 9 months in advance, depending on the retailer. So this was July of 2014. So I had a year to get my ducks in a row to be able to fulfill the demand of Walmart. And Sally Beauty was no different. I was already in production at that time. So it was a little bit easier to fulfill the demand of that purchase order. But this is my stuff on shelf in Walmart and Sally Beauty. There is no greater satisfaction than to walk in a national retailer and see your stuff on shelf. I think the first time I saw my stuff on shelf in Walmart, you know, they don't tell you when your stuff's on shelf. You just have to like, well, they say it's going to be on shelf week 15. So, you know, I'm just going to go and check every day until I find out when my product's on shelf. So I went in Walmart one day and I'm walking down the aisle and I hear these ladies talking. They're like, this stuff smells really good. So I, you know, I speed up, like, what are they talking about? And I turn around the corner and lo and behold, they're in my jars in their hand. And I was, I think I got blacked out. I was like shaking and just being just completely inert. And I was like, that's my stuff. And they're looking at me like, nope, we got this off the shelf. This isn't your stuff. What are you talking about? And I said, no, that's my product. I developed that product. They were like, okay, great. You know, good for you. But, and then I made it worse. And I was like, can I take pictures of you holding our product? So I didn't put that picture in here, but it is still on our social media. And it was just, I didn't know what to do. That's my baby, you know, the baby that I've labored over, cried over, that I've quit a million times, that I've, you know, just given up on and started. It's like a bad relationship. Like, you want to get out, but something just keeps pulling you back in. And, you know, to see it on the shelf, it was just, it's great. So I would, the bad thing is I would go into different stores and I would see stuff dirty or I would always rearrange it because, you know, us as customers, we're just going through not thinking about how the original creator of that product would feel if stuff was moved around. So I would, my husband asked pictures of me. We were in Florida one year and I'm in there rearranging stuff on the shelves. I don't work at Walmart. They're not paying you for that. But, you know, when it's your baby and you see it on display like that, you want it to look its best. Excuse me. So in addition to being in mass retail, if that's something that you're looking to do, you will have a lot of opportunities that will come out of that because it's just something about the American dream, the American story, when a creator takes something and makes it, I don't know why, when we make it to mass retail, when we make it to international borders, it does, you know, stir up the attention of the media. So I've been featured in a couple of magazines. I've been featured, thank you, because I'm over here struggling. Sorry. I've been featured in a couple of magazines. I've been interviewed on ABC 6 News. I've had a couple of interviews with major publications just based on product going to shelf. This is just a clip of one of the newspaper clippings. And some more super cool opportunities. I've been featured in Self Magazine, Ebony, Essence, and Hair Magazine just based on being in mass retail. So creative dreams do come true. I used to always want to be a model, but I never could be a model for whatever the reasons may be. But, you know, just being in mass retail and having my story out there to people has really opened up the opportunity for me to do a lot of the things that I've always wanted to do and only hoped and dreamed that I can do. But just having a product actually make it on shelf has opened up those doors for me. So now we're going to get into telling you some things that you should be aware of as far as getting your product on shelf. Number one is create your story. Excuse me. Creating your story is the most, I think it's the most underrated thing you could ever do, and it's the most valuable thing you could do, and here's why. Does anybody know why influencers are so popular? It's because they have the ability to relate to customers in a way that brands don't. They have a story, they have a lifestyle that people look to, that people trust. People these days don't trust brands. Brands that do most successful in today's market are brands that have a specific person tied to the brand that has a story. I actually was contacted by a company about a year ago, almost a year ago to the day, and they wanted to buy my company because they were looking to buy a company that had a person with a story attached to it. In addition to not just buying the company, but they were going to buy, they're buying me is what they were saying. Like, Tasha, we want you. We want to buy you. And essentially, they wanted to buy my story because your story can't be manufactured. Your story is what made you start creating the product that you have. Why are you passionate about it? What is your hope as far as being able to impact and change people's lives? Those are the things that create the story that are essentially the power behind your product. Otherwise, for example, hair care products and skincare products, anybody could take coconut oil, water, aloe juice, almond oil, or whatnot, and create a cream, right? Anybody has access to those same ingredients. There's recipes online. It's really simple to create that formulation. But what makes one formulation stand out in front of the other? It's the story that's behind it, the why. It's the personality that's attached to it. It's the overall branding is not necessarily just your logo and how your products look to get when they're all packaged together. It's the complete story that is packaged with your product. That is what's going to help push your product and give you leverage above any of your competitors that are already out there on the shelves. Like if you think about, if you think about Jergens or Garnier or Organics or some of those other brands, nobody knows anything about why those products were started. We just kind of use them because they're there, because we're familiar with them, we've seen them on commercials. But if you could take something like a Burt's Bees that's got an actual story, people love Burt. People love everything around the Burt's Bees brand. Even though Burt is no longer with us, his legacy still carries on and pushes the brand. Even though before he passed away, he had given up the rights to that company years before that. But his story was so powerful and people were able to connect to him and the trust behind the brand that his story is what carried it. And his story is what still continues to carry the brand when he's not even here to have his two cents and his say into formulations, packaging, where the product is going to go. The story is what carries it. So creating your story is the single most important thing that you could ever do. When you meet with lenders, when you meet with organizations for funding, they're going to want to know the story behind your brand. Our business plans look a little bit different than somebody that might not be a creative, because what people are investing money in outside of the product, they're investing their money in you. So your story is equally important, if not more important, than the product that you're actually tied to. So decide who your customer is. This is going to help determine whether mass retail is really a good fit for you. And not just mass retail in general, but the specific stores. So I've been in a couple different stores in mass retail, and I can definitely say that not all stores are created equal. Not all stores will be the best fit for your brand, depending on the type of customer that they have. Like, I absolutely loved being in relationship with Walmart. Being in relationship with Walmart. But one thing that I have had repeatedly from the investors that I've met with is that your product is not a Walmart type product. Your product is higher end. Your product should be in a Target, or your product should be in a store that has a higher quality, I guess you could say, as far as the presentation, the other products that it carries. And that forced me to look at some things, because I'm looking at my product, looking at my price point, looking at my packaging, wondering if the person that would be attracted to my product is even walking in Walmart stores. And if she's not, how do I get her in those stores? But that's not to say that mass retail isn't for me. What about Sally Beauty? Sally Beauty, we've been in Sally Beauty. That's a store where they sell hair care products. And based on my price point, based on the packaging, I may have a better chance at reaching my target customer based on it being in Sally's versus a Walmart or versus a Walgreens or another store that carries products out of my category. So looking at your product name, the packaging design, and your pricing structure, those are some of the things that can help you decide who your customer is. I would even recommend doing a customer, and I know this sounds super duper weird, but one thing I had to do was I had to go online on Instagram or Pinterest, and I found maybe like 4 or 5 pictures of just random women that I never knew. And I wrote a story about each one based on what I thought her lifestyle was. So I would say this customer, she likes to read, she likes to travel, she's a successful woman, she's within this age range, she makes this much money, this is the type of lifestyle she has, this is my customer. And then I would do that for each and every customer, and what that did in turn is that would help me to figure out, where's this customer shopping at? And are the products, are the stores that my product's in, are those stores that these women are shopping in? And sometimes it was no, and it had to, I had to kind of refocus my goals and my target to realize that where I'm wanting my product to be, my customer is not shopping. So those are definitely things that are helpful for you, is to try to do, look at your current customer base, look at the men and the women who are currently buying your products, and to, if you're able to get any kind of demographics based on whatever analytics you may have with, I don't know what kind of e-commerce packaging that you have, but sometimes it gets really, really deep. You can even get on your Facebook pages. If you've got Facebook business pages, you're able to go in there and look at the demographics of your page to know that the majority of your people are within this age range, they live in this area. This is the times that they're online, this is the income that they make, these are their hobbies and their interests, and that'll help, that it'll basically tell you who your customers are. So if you're able to kind of, I know Facebook is like a necessary evil, unfortunately, but it's got really great analytics that are, you just can't compare those to anything else out there for free that you can find as a business owner. So if you can utilize some of Facebook's analytics, you can see who your customers are. And if you're not able to see that, I don't know what kind of e-commerce package you have, but Facebook has a pixel that you can use, that you can take the pixel from Facebook and apply it to your website, and it'll tell you the type of people that are going to your website, if what the abandoned cart rate is, though you can remarket to those people, but it'll help you see who your customer is. So if you can take that data and see who your customer is online, pretty much who you are attracting online is who you would attract in real life in stores. So you would be able to see if different stores are better for you or if they're just something that's not going to work for your business plan. Every store attracts a different customer. So what is my number one rule? Get your stalker on. Yes, get your stalker on. I know there's a little miniature stalker on the inside of us. It's okay. I'm not going to judge you. But one thing that you need to do is study your stores and their customers. So before I even got into mass retail, I used to stalk Target like 20. I used to think they were going to escort me out of there because I used to stalk it so bad. I would take my products in there. I would put it on the shelf next to other products. Then I would walk by to see if my products catch their eye. And if I would take pictures of my products on the shelf so that I can go home and say, is this standing out to me? Is this capturing my eye like some of the other products that are on the shelf? Because the way my consumer shops is they like to be kind of like interested on all of the major senses, like the way it looks, the way it smells, the way the products feel, because you know customers are going to touch your stuff. There's nothing you can really do about that. But those are things that I used to do to measure how I wanted my product to be packaged. So just take some time in there and study like what kind of customers do they have, how the products on the shelves are, how they're designed, how they're displayed, because that's going to help you in the long run to know how your product is going to look, how it's going to be handled, and how it's going to look and feel on the shelves of those retailers. Also, study other brands that are in your category. So kind of like I mentioned earlier with Walmart, that's also something that I did before getting into relationship with Walmart, was I studied the other categories, other brands in my categories, because I wanted to see like what they were doing. I mean, I'm trying to get to where they are as far as getting repeat purchase orders, staying in relationship with retailers beyond the initial supplier agreement, which is anywhere from 6 to 12 to 18 months. So I want to do what you're doing, but I want to do it better. So in order for me to do what you're doing and do it better, I have to learn what you're doing. And I'm only going to do that by signing up for your mailing list, being a fan of your Facebook, following your Instagram, just to be abreast of what you're doing, how you're speaking to your customers, how you're getting engagement, if you're hiring influencers, and how you are using Facebook ads to gain the attention of potential customers. So all those things are very important, because the reality is, if you get in bed with Walmart or Target or any other retailer, they're going to expect you to perform like your competitors do. And they're not going to necessarily take into the account that you may be a smaller brand. If you are saying that you are in a category of body care, multicultural hair care, apparel, food or whatnot, when you enter into those categories, they're going to expect you to do all the other things that your other competitors are doing. And quite frankly, some of the things that my competitors were doing were things that I could never even fathom investing the amount of money into doing. A lot of it was for me and what I wanted to do as far as my target, my hopes, and my plans as far as creating a lifestyle brand around natural hair care. It just wasn't something that I was willing to invest the time and energy into. So it's good to know that stuff up front before you decide you want to get into retail, because retailers are going to have that expectation from you. So, like, I don't know if you're aware of this, but, like, when you go into, like, a Sally Beauty and they ask you, you know, hi, how can I help you today? Are you looking for anything in particular? And you say, yeah, you know, I'm looking for a hot oil treatment or looking for some hair dye, and they give you suggestions, right? They're not giving you suggestions based on they've tried these products and they know how they work. They're giving you suggestions because us as suppliers, I don't even know if I should be sharing this, but us as suppliers, when we go into these retailers, we tell the retailers all of the benefits and attributes of the product. We tell them what seasons they work best in, what the key ingredients are. We tell them what they work with, who they work for, and we tell them that so that they know what to tell you. Otherwise, they won't know. So it's really good to know how your competitors are leveraging their space on those retail shelves, because you will absolutely be expected to do the same thing. And we're required to educate our retailers as far as how our products are, how good they work, and what who our target customer is, because they don't know. They take the data that we give them, and they decide how many stores we're going to put you in and what stores we're going to put you in based on the markets that we think that they'll do best in. And based on that information is where you'll know how many stores you'll be carried in and what areas that you'll be carried in. So acquiring funding is the biggest challenge. I think out of everything that I've ever done in mass retail, funding has been the biggest challenge. And you would think, because, well, I've got a purchase order from Whole Foods, that lenders will be beating the door down to give you money to fund a purchase order. And that couldn't be further from the truth. So some things that will help you in the long haul as far as making acquiring funding easier is to be sure that you have a profit and loss statement handy and up to date, and keep at least the last 3 years. If you're like me, numbers and Excel sheets make me sleepy, and they are super duper confusing, because I would rather make stuff pretty and make stuff with my hands and not have to deal with formulas. So I actually worked with someone that helped me do forecasting and profit and loss, because those are things that not only retailers are going to want that stuff, lenders are going to want it too. So it's good to keep that stuff on hand if you don't already, as far as profit loss, as far as forecasting, inventory, marketing plans, like having all of that data. That's why I said our business plans may look a little bit different than someone in a different industry, because you're dealing with an actual product that's a lifestyle brand. Lenders and retailers are going to want to see that you have more concrete information around your brand and what you expect it to do and how you expect it to perform. So it's a good idea to have the value of any standing inventory you may have and any equipment that you have, because lenders probably will not may use this as equity in any loans that you have. So that is one thing that lenders are going to ask, like, how much inventory do you have on hand? What kind of, do you have a facility? Do you have any equipment? Because they'll use those things as collateral to give you a loan. Like, okay, we'll give you a loan based on how much inventory you have and what the value is on the machinery and equipment that you use to fill and produce your products. So if you've got $5,000 worth of inventory and you've got $10,000 worth of machinery, then they'll probably give you a loan up to $15,000. And that's just based on how many years you've been in business, how much cash flow you have. Cash flow is huge. Like, one thing I kept running into is that before a lot of lenders will give you money, they want to know that you have enough cash flow on hand today. How much money do you have in the bank? Do you have at least 3 months cash flow? And I'm thinking, if I had 3 months cash flow, I wouldn't be submitting an application for a loan. But that's just the reality when it comes to business lending. You can also go the route of having a money factor. A money factor is if you have a purchase order in hand from any major retailer, a money factor will give you money at like an ungodly interest rate, probably around 20-something%. They usually fund around 70% of the value of the purchase order. But typically the hard part as a small business is that like you don't already have like 30 grand of inventory just ready to ship to a mass retailer. And mass retailers typically want large quantities, even if they only start you off with like 100 stores or so. They want product to go in store. They want product to go in warehouses. So when you get that purchase order, they have this thing called lead time. How many of you have heard of lead time? Lead time is typically any time from 2 to 6 days from the date that your purchase order has been submitted. They want that purchase order filled, like no questions asked, and they don't like to be late, and they will penalize you from being late. So unless you have a bunch of inventory already on hand, a money factor might not be the right avenue for you, just because you have to already have the inventory ready to drop ship. And if you're a small business, you typically need that money to go into production, which depending on what you're trying to produce can take anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks. And I've been in that before where you kind of got to explain the nasty reality to retailers, like, hey, you know, I'm a small business, so I know your purchase order has a 5-day lead time, but can we extend it? And they don't like to, but they will. Will they extend it 6 to 8 weeks? Absolutely not. So before you get into retail, I encourage you to look and explore different opportunities to make sure that you have enough inventory on hand to ship when you get your first purchase order. So you need to have the funding and marketing strategy in place that will drive customers into each store that your products are carried in. If it's not hard enough to drive people to your website, imagine trying to drive customers to 300 different stores in 300 different cities across America, and sometimes even, you know, Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, depending on your retailer. So that is definitely a challenge, because as a small business, you're like, okay, well, geez, Facebook is always in my pocket telling me to boost stuff and to do ads. So now I got to think about that in addition to trying to figure out how I'm going to market to get to the 5 locations you have in Atlanta, the 8 locations that you have in Miami, the 10 locations that you have in Los Angeles. That's a real thing as far as trying to figure out ways to drive traffic into individual stores, because they will have an expectation that you turn so many units per store per week in order to keep a standing relationship with that retailer. And if you're not able to meet that demand, then they can end your relationship and the contract could be ended. Then they can make you pay for any markdowns that they have to do in store to get rid of the product in store. And then they will ship everything in their warehouse back to you at your expense. So you absolutely want to make sure that before you even entertain the idea of waltzing with any mass retailer, that you want to either work with a marketing firm or work with a team of people that can help you to drive traffic into each individual store that your product is carried in. So, and their website, the retailer website, just a quick bunny trail. I'm not going to put anybody's name out there, but said retailer that we were in relationship with, they would actually monitor our social media. And if they felt like we were not giving them enough shine, we would get a little email like, so what's your strategy for this week? So we want to be included in more of your marketing plan. And I didn't like that, because we have a specific message and a specific voice that we like to talk to our customers in. I don't want to always be that brand that's always like, buy this, buy this, buy this, buy this. You want to create relationship with your customers, right? You want to create conversation, engagement, community. But when you have a retailer that their bottom line is sales, you kind of have to bend and bow to that. So we would have to incorporate additional marketing to meet their demand and to meet their request of how much per week we talked about their our product being on their shelves. And these are the stores that you can go to in Mississippi. And creating marketing strategies around the stores that we want to drive people to in Mississippi and the stores that aren't performing as much. What can we do to get more people in those stores? That stuff is your responsibility. I know you may get like, I don't know how many of you still get like the newspaper where you get like the Sunday ads and things like that, that you go through that. You know, silly me, I used to think that, oh, how nice, you know, that these brands must be doing great because CVS and Walgreens are including them in these weekly mailers. No. Brands are paying top dollar to be distributed into every home in America once a week. They pay for that. That's not something that the retailers do as a courtesy. Retailers don't do anything as a courtesy. Nothing. No thing at all whatsoever. You even have to be careful at how they submit purchase orders to you because sometimes, or how they pay you, because I think with Walmart, if you get paid every net 30 terms, they take a certain percentage out your purchase order for that versus you choosing to do 60 or 90 day terms. The longer you can delay in allowing them to pay you back for inventory, the less that they'll take out of your check up front. So even that, like, you're thinking to yourself, like, wait. So you send me a purchase order for my products that you want in your store. I send it to you at my expense because I pay for the shipping. But then when it's time for you to pay me, I have to pay you again if I want my money in 30 days, like, to keep operating. But that's just the reality of mass retail. So you need to have insurance for your product, which can vary per retailer. Insurance, I know you can have indie insurance as a crafter or creator if something is made by you. But once you go into mass production, if you enter into an agreement with a contract manufacturer where it's no longer being produced by you or in your facility, that takes you out of having the indie kind of startup insurance. You have to get like a higher grade of insurance. And that, depending on whatever the retailers say you have to have as far as like your deductibles and coverage, it can run you anywhere from $400 to over $1,000 per month. For insurance, and you have to pay a certain amount up front, a down payment, because in order to make monthly payments, they have to conduct a credit check on you to see if you can maintain making monthly payments. So I don't know about your personal credit, but your personal credit, unfortunately, in this day and age, matters in a major way when you are dealing business. It's not so much separated anymore; it's all together. So you need to be able to mass produce to meet the demands of retailers and their lead time. Your lead time needs to fit the requirements of whatever retailer you enter into partnership with. We kind of went over that a little bit. And retailers do run credit checks. So in order to get into Walmart, and then we were at Sally Beauty, they actually did a business credit check on us. Are you familiar with Dunn's, D-U-N-S? Okay, Dunn's number is what you'll need to apply for as a business to have. It's almost like you get a Dunn's number, just like a 7 or 8 digit number, and every retailer that you enter into agreement with is going to want that Dunn's number so that if you ever default on any kind of balance that you have with them, that they report that. So it won't be like on your Experian or TransUnion or Equifax credit report. It'll be on your Dunn's credit report, and it'll show all of the accounts that you have that are in good standing, ones that have balances that haven't been paid. So you can actually apply for a Dunn's number now. So you can Google Dunn's number. I don't know the website off the top of my head, but you can set up a Dunn's number for free. And what I would encourage you to do on whatever level you can is to begin utilizing net 30 terms, maybe with companies that you buy your supplies from now. And even getting credit worthiness letters from retailers or vendors that you buy your supplies from now, because that's going to help. You want stuff to report on there even now, because your Dunn's number, you have a score between like 1 and like 9. And if your score does not fall within the range of that particular retailer, they can deny your ability to do business with them. So you actually want to be working on that proactively, so that when you are ready to make that turn to get into mass retail, that you've already been working to build your business credit. And that's one thing I did not do. So another thing I want to, this is kind of random, but make sure you're making money off of your products. So depending on what it costs you to make it, what it costs you to ship it, what it costs you to package it, when you're shipping to retail and then they decide, okay, when you set your MSRP, your suggested retail price, and you have your wholesale price, that you're making money off of it. We actually had an incident with the retailer. So one of my products doesn't have a water base, so it's all butters. And that's the most expensive product I have to make. So one of my retailers lowballed me so much that on a $13.99 8-ounce jar, I was only making 50 cents. In addition to that, they wanted us to continue to put that item on sale. Like, we want you to do, we're having a special this month. We want to include your items. Can you discount that? Well, if I discount it, like, I'll be making negative 25 cents on this item. Like, I can't afford to discount it anymore. So always remember that retailers are going to negotiate in terms that best fit them and best suit them. But they're major mass retailers that got money coming in and funneling in from every angle that you could possibly think. And they have hundreds of other retailers just like you that they make lots of money off of. Negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. Don't think that you have to get into a specific retailer or a mass retailer in order to make it and be successful. You can make a decision to get in bed with the retailer and it can completely and totally take your business all the way under. You can lose your business behind trying to do business with some of these big box retailers. And they've been known to shut businesses down. So much so, if you think about this, so how many of you have been into Walmart and you are buying lotion and you see the Equate brand and you buy it because it's like a dollar and not $3 like Jergan? So think about this. So Walmart is the low price leader. Do you want to know why they're able to even use that term and to function as a low price leader? Because typically they make you sign a document at the time that you set up your agreement that no other retailer can sell this, your item, lower than what Walmart can sell it as. In addition to that, Walmart will also, and other retailers, will ask you for exclusivity. Like, can we be the only retailer that sells this product? Because that gives them leverage. For you, that boxes you in like you've only got this one retail outlet carrying this product when you can have several. But Walmart is saying, I only want to have the rights to this product. We want it exclusively. We don't want anybody else to have it. So when you think about stuff like that, and then you think about the Equate brand, Equate and those private label brands are used to be in competition with Jergens or whatever other categories. You see it in toothpaste, cleaners, food items. They're in competition with the very brands that they do business with. So they're like, I'm going to buy your product, okay? I'm going to buy it. I'm going to set it on our shelves. And so you're getting visibility and everything. But then I'm going to go create a product just like yours. I'm going to call it something else. I'm going to put it under the Equate brand. Change the ingredients around just a little bit. Maybe have the fragrance, or maybe not, because your fragrance isn't pageants. It's a fragrance. Anybody can duplicate it. You know, so you're thinking that you've got this relationship with Walmart, but they don't really care about it like that because they went and duplicated your product, your hard work, your blood, sweat, and tears, and then put their lower price item right next to yours on their shelf. So I'm saying that to say I'm not bad mouthing retailers. These are just things that I've learned in the process that have helped me because it was kind of like a culture shocker, like I was like, oh my gosh, you know, because I didn't realize this stuff really existed. But it is a very, it's a very hard game that big box retailers play. And my hope in my heart is that, you know, for you as small business owners, that you don't allow it to deter you, you don't allow it to intimidate you into feeling like you have to take whatever deal they give you because you need their space. They actually need companies in order to remain functioning. In essence, they need businesses and brands more so than you as a business or brand can need a large retailer. You can continue to function, whether Walmart, Target, or Walgreens is here tomorrow, but they can't function if they don't have an influx of new products and new brands, you know, fighting for their shelf space. So make sure you're making money off of your products. You may have to contract with a partner with a contract manufacturer that can help you mass produce your products and to help you properly ship your items to your retailers. Every retailer has different shipping requirements as far as what size, what kind of pallets, how we want them delivered. Walmart is specific, like you got to deliver them around this time of the day, and if it's before this or after this, we can reject your shipment, ship it back to you, and then penalize you because you were early or late on your purchase order. But then as far as mass producing, most of us don't have the ability to produce at the demand of, you know, a $200,000 or $300,000 purchase order. So you need a contract manufacturer that can produce, whether it's body care, whether it's clothing. But it's helpful to have those kind of relationships in the event that you get a purchase order. They have access to supplies and ingredients and things at a much lower rate than we can get them at. Because typically in small business, we're not getting things at the huge discount breaks. We're just kind of getting them that a middleman has purchased it from a middleman has purchased it from a middleman. So we're still paying a lot for it versus if we use a contract filler or a contract manufacturer that's able to get things in 500-pound drums or, you know, in much larger quantities, we can get a better discount, which will help us to get a better markup for our products. So if you do use a contract filler, if you have a personal care product, please make sure you own your formulations. Here's the trick for contract fillers. You will say, okay, I've got this purchase order for CVS. They want this many units. Here's my formulation, because you know we all keep our formulations, so we know how much oil to use and at what temperature and everything like that. So the key to that is when we make them in smaller batches, when you take a 50-pound batch and you turn that into something that's 500 or 5,000 pounds, it's almost like taking and making a recipe for a cake for one person and then trying to take that same recipe and duplicate it for the for cake that can fill everybody that could fit in this conference room. So things are different. You know, you might, your egg ratio might be different, or, you know, how long you have to, I don't know, whip it might be different, or the amount, or when you add this ingredient might be at a different time, just at a different temperature, because the batch is bigger, so it's hotter, so it takes longer to cool. So the key word is your products have to be stable. Stable meaning they have to, when they're on in the warehouse, if you've got a natural product that's got like a natural, a natural preservative in it, can it withstand sitting in a warehouse that gets to be 90 degrees? Is that going to make it spoil? Can it withstand being on a truck that gets to be 100 degrees? Like, is that going to compromise the integrity of the product? You have to think about those things. And what contract manufacturers will say is your product isn't stable. So we had to change your formulation to make your product stable. So once they change the formulation, guess who owns it now? Not you, because they've changed it. So now it's their formulation. So you need to work out an agreement with your contract manufacturer that you will own your formulation. That if you decide today, I don't want to work with you anymore, I want a contract manufacturer over in another state, that you can pack up your things and go, and that you're not having to go to court behind a formulation that you thought was yours that no longer belongs to you. It belongs to this manufacturer. Made that mistake myself twice. So you definitely want to make sure that you own your formulation, own your fragrance. Yes?
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to know, so in a situation like that, where they, do you own that formulation?
Well, the tricky part is that what I would do is I would take my formulation, and I don't know what this costs, but there are labs, depending on where you live, there are research and development labs that you can take your product to and say, I want to make sure this is stable. So even though this might be a 4-ounce jar, in the event that I want to take this 4-ounce jar and make this, you know, a 500-gallon formulation, you know, like, does this work? And they can take what you do and take your formulation, your recipe that you want to make sure that you've got a non-disclosure agreement. That's golden. You want to make sure that you've got agreements with them signed, that they can't take your stuff and run with it afterwards. but they can take your formulation and say, yes, this is stable, or based on this ingredient, you may want to add an additional preservative, or there's different things that they can suggest.
Okay.
But it is a research and development lab. But even in that, just make sure you've got your non-disclosure agreement form set in place so that you can talk to them in all confidence that they're not sharing that with anyone. Outside of that, I don't know any other ways to ensure, because most contract billers have a research and development team there on hand where they have people that used to get good grades in science when they were in school, and they do nothing but like deal with the science of ingredients and how they react to one another and how they respond in different environments. So I think, that is something that could be costly, but you have to determine whether you want to make sure that you own that formulation, or if you're okay with giving it to a contract filler and they are now the owner of the formulation, if you're okay with that. So it just really depends on where the value is. I ended up having to take what the contract filler did and reverse engineer it. Now there are companies that'll do reverse engineering. It's like $12,000 per product though, where they can basically take it and undo it and make, you know, go backwards and tell you exactly what's in there. But you can, when you go through a contract filler, you'll get something called a MSDS. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's required before you go into any retailer. And what that does is it says, you know, if this spills or if this gets in somebody's mouth somehow, this is what's in it. It's 46% water. It's got this. It's in compliance with Proposition 65, blah, 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 or whatever, you know, it needs to have. You can look at that and say, I know the formulations have a wide range, but you can at least see in, you know, what percentage that they use and try to see if you can kind of work it backwards. Yeah, it'll take some time, but that's a more cost-effective way. And just making sure that you have all your stuff down, like in gram weights and everything like that. But that's just kind of one of those necessary evils with that. Trademark your brand, another mistake I made. All these slides are based off mistakes I made. Woo! So my brand used to be called Milk and Honey because I thought it was cute, you know. And I did a trademark search from USPTO, I think it's the test system. And I looked up Milk and Honey, and I didn't see any actual products Milk and Honey, but I did see a salon in San Antonio, Texas, I think, that was Milk and Honey Hair Salon. And I went and looked them up. They didn't have any products, but they were a salon.
We had it in Austin.
Yes. Yes.
It's kind of a thing.
It is. That's where it was.
There's
Austin.
There's also a restaurant in LA, because Milk and Honey is also a physical reference.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also a really good,
it's a tough one, but that's you come up with these super cute names and then someone else has already trademarked them. So I was about 45 days out from going into Walmart, and I get this on Facebook. This attorney messaged me on Facebook, like, how petty. So the person that was managing my Facebook was like, Dasha, there's this message in your inbox. You need to look at it now. So I went and looked at it, and I'm like, oh, Jiminy Crickets. Okay, so we're 45 days out, guys. Like, what? I had to come up. I literally had a mental breakdown because I was so like emotionally attached to the name. I had a whole story around the name, and you're getting ready to go into mass retail. So what you're doing is you're leveraging your customer relationships, your customer trust. You're leveraging that already to go behind your efforts in mass retail. So now to change the name, it's like you gotta now educate your customers. Like, hey, we're not selling out, or no one's buying the company or anything like that, but we've got to change the name. So I had to come up with a creative way to change this name. So what happened was, category 3 in trademark class is like shampoos, body care products, and I think it's salons in there also. But I thought that I was okay. No, salon is a different category, but I thought I was okay because there wasn't a physical product. Well, digging deep into their documents, which you can see everybody's documents on the USPTO website, encourage you to do that. They did trademark Milk and Honey for actual shampoos and whatnot, even though that they weren't selling it, I guess, in the event that they decided to do that. And I was infringing on that because I had a product name in the same category. Thank God that I found that out before I got into Walmart, because if I would have gone into production with Milk and Honey on everything and went on Walmart shelves for over 300 stores, then I'd have been like, oh, so hey, Walmart, you know, all that product stuff we sent you, we need that back, you know, and that would have been an expensive mistake on my part. So make sure that your name is clear in trademark, and I would trademark my name. Before you hit mass retail, you want to make sure that's trademarked. I know trademarking formulations and patents and things like that is tricky, but if you own what you've done, if there's something spectacular and specific about what you've created and how you've created it, if you can trademark it, do it, because I don't know how much you follow, like, I almost said the name, some retailers online, they're really notorious for ripping off artists, small artists, you know, like me and you. So, like, make sure that whatever you can, you want to make sure you have all of your legalities in place, that in the event that you have to pursue any kind of legal anything with anybody, that you make sure that you've got all of your grounds covered. So getting into every retailer is different. One thing that helped me, I didn't do this with Walmart, but I did do this with Sally Beauty. I started working with a broker. There are brokers that are versed in different categories, whether it's apparel, food, beauty. And the beautiful thing about brokers is that they already have a relationship with the buyers of these retailers. So instead of you going to the website applying, instead of you going to the website applying, like most retailers, you can have your broker go and pitch initially on your behalf and secure an appointment with the buyers for you. And that way you can kind of go in through the back door. You'll still have to fill out all the paperwork, but it's a lot easier if you're leveraging the relationships that brokers have with buyers. You typically end up paying them royalties off of your purchase order. But if that's an option that you want to do, they don't just help you get an appointment to meet with a buyer, but they also act as an extension of your company in a position that you don't have to go and hire somebody to be your sales manager or to be your relations manager. And they manage different retail relationships. So they are able to tell you, well, these are things that Walmart wants specifically. These are the deadlines. These are the things that they like to see. These are the things that Whole Foods like. These are the things that they like to see. This is their requirements. They're going to want this. You're going to have to change this. And those are things that you and I just don't know. You know, we're not, unless you kind of are already doing business with them, you kind of learn some of the opportunities, some of the areas that they kind of don't cover as much. You don't know those things unless you have someone that's kind of in a relationship with them. Walmart has a system called Retail Link where you get to kind of go in there and see how your product's doing, look at inventory levels. That system is like the Matrix. It's the most difficult, challenging, like easiest to understand contraption I've ever tried to log in on the back end and look at. But the broker knew it like the back of their hand, and they were able to go in there, extract reports, pull data, and everything, and it just made my life a whole heck of a lot easier. So having a broker will help you to avoid playing the apply and wait game. So I don't know if you ever submitted your application to a retailer before, but you can never hear from them and never know where you're at on the list. But having a broker to secure an appointment with the buyer is definitely helpful. You can also use sites such as RangeMe to get in front of retailers without using a broker. But again, that's just kind of that I'm going to put myself out there and hope that I get some bites from it. You don't necessarily know, if you'll get any responses from it, but you might. So that's one platform I see a lot of retailers moving to. It used to be where you can go log on the back end of Target and go to their partner online system. I think it used to be called POL. And even Whole Foods, you used to be able to go and apply directly to the website. But like now everybody's like, yeah, go over there to RangeMe, and if we're interested, we'll let you know. So it's a little impersonal, you know, because you don't get the opportunity to get in front of a buyer and pitch. But that is an option that you do have. Make sure you understand your supplier agreement. Every agreement with every retailer is going to be different, but you want to make sure that it works best for your company and for your brand. As far as when you get paid, if there is exclusivity, if your product is on consignment, Those are all that stuff is in supplier agreements. You just want to make sure you don't check the wrong box where you're thinking, where's my payment? And they're like, oh, yeah, so your product's just on here on our shelves. And if it sells, then we will give you 40%. That way you can discuss what your sales rate is as far as, okay, you're going to buy products for 50% of my MSRP, and then you're going to sell it for this amount. All that stuff is in the supply agreement. What happens with returns? Because I don't know if you know this, but when customers return products back to the store, guess who pays for them? Retailers do. When they go on sale, guess who pays for the difference? Retailers do. We pay for all that stuff. So you want to make sure that you're aware of what the costs are, any fees. You want to make sure that you have an understanding in your agreement how you even get purchase orders. Some companies will just send you a purchase order via email. Some will expect you to sign up for an EDI solution, third party, which will give you electronic purchase orders, and that is something that you will have to pay for based on the amount of data exchange. So you want to make sure that you read through it thoroughly. I had an attorney look at mine because it was like in French to me. It was like 20 pages, and I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't signing my life away. So if you have an attorney friend, or if there's a low-cost attorney in your area that can look over these agreements to make sure that you're making the best decision for your company, I highly advise that. Retail shelving is some of the most valuable real estate in the world. They want to see you turn units. So I don't know if you know this, but when you walk into any aisle, you can typically, that retail shelf is like, that's the most highly competitive real estate ever like created. And a lot of times you can tell how a product is doing based on where it is on the shelf. So if it's on the bottom, there's like one or two, and you see a sale ticket on it, it's not really doing that well. If it's at the top or eye level, those are very high performing items. You want to be in that eye range, at least from eye to like waist range. You don't want to be below waist because nobody walks the aisle looking at their feet. But that is something that you want to think about, because most retailers will say, in order, so our supplier agreement is that we will carry your product for 12 months. But in order, the contingency on that is we will carry you for 12 months if you are selling 500 units per store per week. Geez, that's a lot, right? But you have to do your part in the marketing side and making sure that you've got traffic going into those stores to turn those units. Because if you're not turning those units, then they can end your contract, and then you will be forced to allow them to sell your product at an extremely unnecessary discount rate, and then you'll have to buy back whatever they can't sell, and then they'll have to send you everything back in their warehouse, which in turn you will have to pay for also. So you definitely want to understand your agreement to know like what the expectation is of you, so that you can make sure that you're turning the units that are required to maintain the shelf space that they're lending you for exposure. You as a brand are responsible for the return. So I kind of talked about that. I jump ahead of myself all the time, and then I get to the slide like, oh, hey, we covered that already. So you are responsible for any returns for any of your customers. And one of our retailers, it would upset me because I would go, you know, I'm obsessed about making sure my product looks great. I would go look at my product on shelves. It would be dirty, lids missing, big scoop marks out of the jar because people were scooping out of there. That stuff's not going to sell, so who's going to pay for it? I am. And it's unfortunate. Sometimes the stuff would be just dirty, misplaced, and it wasn't because of on my behalf. I shipped it to you in a, you know, in a box, in a crate, in a pallet, and you got it perfectly. But unfortunately, based on how you keep the products in the warehouse, whether you have people maintaining, keeping your shelves clean, sometimes products, unfortunately, don't get the level of care and maintenance that they need to still look nice. Not all retailers are like that. Some are, but you will be responsible for paying for that even if it's not your fault.
I think it goes back to you.
You.
If you go to Target,
you have an option. You can decide that you can give the retailer the ability to dispose it, or they can send them all back to you. I didn't want it. So I was like, you can just throw them all away. So, yeah, you decide that in your supplier agreement, how you want returns to be handled. You're responsible for any damages and products that don't sell. So with all that said, get your pitch on. You have to be super duper confident in your product and its abilities. I know I said a lot today that may not have been like the most encouraging thing, and it's not that I don't want to encourage you. I just want you to be armed with the truth, because I kind of went into retail relationship with like rose-colored spectacles on, and they were immediately removed once I saw how much responsibility I had and what direction that was really taking the company, and I had no idea. So be confident in your products. You will not only have to convince retailers that they need your product, but you will have to tell them why. Buyers are always on the hunt for the next big thing. They actually, some buyers, depending on the retailers, they have quotas and commissions, quotas that they have to make and commissions that they make on getting new relationships and getting new products on shelf. They always want to be ahead of the game, carrying the hottest, latest, you know, fanciest product, so they don't always know off the top of their head, you know, who's the latest and greatest product. Occasionally, you'll get a message in your inbox from a large retailer like, hey, I want some samples. Can you send them to me? And that's great, but those are few and far in between. For the most part, you'll have to be proactive in reaching out to retailers and giving them the reason why. This is why you need my product on your shelf. This is the type of customer that is going to come to your store to just alone to buy my product, because this is the market that my product is a part of. You're not taking advantage of this demographic. You're not taking advantage of this market. These are some opportunities that you can use as a business to tap into an uncharted demographic of customers that you haven't been able to reach. But that's just like knowing your customer, knowing your market, stalking everything you possibly can, and just really having an intimate knowledge of your customer, what she wants, where she shops, what she likes, what she doesn't, what she needs. You'll be responsible for educating retailers for that, because they don't know. And a lot of times it's kind of like the parent that wants to be cool and with it, but they're not. So like they have to rely on their kids to tell them what's in and what's not. You're the kid that's in there and that's with it, trying to tell the parent that's completely out of touch, like, this is what you need to carry on your shelf to be cool. So you have to kind of have that posture and that mindset if you're looking to approach mass retail. So your job is to convince them why your product will draw new traffic to their store, and what you're willing to do as a brand to put support behind it. Mass retail can be the catalyst that changes the direction of your business. It can really be the thing that opens you. It gives you the amount of exposure you get with mass retail is incomparable, because there are still some people that want to walk into a store, pick up a product, sniff it, squeeze it, smell it, you know, test it a little bit, even though they shouldn't, because we have to pay for those. There are companies that just want to do, there are people that just want to do that. And that's something that you can't put a dollar amount on. So if you can get a relationship with the retailer, it can absolutely change the direction of your brand and give it a level of exposure that you never had before. So before you engage into even exploring the idea of a mass retail relationship, I encourage you to take the time to think and reflect. Like, is this something I can do right now? Don't rush into it. Is this something that can wait? What are some things I can put into place now? Is this really where I want to go? Mass retail is not the end-all, be-all of your brand. It's not the thing that's going to be guaranteed success. There are many brands that manage to dodge mass retail, and they're really successful with their career. They're really successful with their product. So really weighing all the positives, all the negatives, all the options to see if this is something you want to do. I encourage you to just do one at a time. I juggled two mass retailers at a time, and even with a broker, that was a lot of responsibility, a lot of work. We had one incident with a purchase order that almost completely and totally destroyed my business. It was a purchase order where, so typically when you ship to mass retail, they have distribution centers that you ship to, and based on that distribution center will ship to maybe, you know, several hundred stores within a specific radius. So we had three distribution centers on our purchase order. My manufacturer, contract filler, because they know mass retail, they were like, Tasha, this doesn't look right. You should have another distribution center on there. We know this retailer. These are the four places they ship to, but you only have three. So I checked with the retailer. They're like, nope, it's fine. So I went back to my contract filler. Nope, they said it's fine. So the retailer was like, all right, you know, we'll go into production for this purchase order, and, you know, we should have it filled whatever time zone or whatever. So then we get everything shipped. Then this retailer emails us like, oh, hey, so we forgot this distribution center. Can you have this stuff to us in about 4 days? Like, what? No? Because we don't just have that amount of inventory just sitting waiting to be shipped. So we had to, I had to ship whatever I had on hand, and I was still short. But what that did was when customers would try to go to our website to place orders, we didn't have the inventory to fill it because we had to make up for this retailer's mistake. We had a lot of upset customers. There was a lot of orders that we could not fill, but that was based on their mistake. And that one mistake for a large company, probably nothing, but when you're a smaller company, that can determine whether you're going to be able to continue operating or not. And that's kind of where we were with it. And it was very devastating to us financially, but we were able to recover from it, barely, but we were able to recover from it. But just knowing all of the, you know, when we make mistakes on the level that we are now, it's a lot easier to recover from. But when you are dealing with larger numbers like that and larger retailers that don't necessarily, you know, they're more, they don't flinch as much as we do because of the size that they are, it really just reflect and think, like, is this something I want to do? Maybe make that a five-year goal. You know, retailers are always going to be here. You're not going to miss anything if you wait 5 years, push it out 3 years. But just determine, like, is this something that I want to do now, or is this something I want to do later?